The morning is Ridge Chrysler Jeep against Daimler Chrysler Financial Services.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tim Eaton on behalf of the appellant, and I'm here with my co-counsel, Patricia Spratt and Dana Pesha. Your Honor, this case involves the use of the district court's inherent powers as well as issuing sanctions under Rule 37 and 41. Particularly, the case law is emphasized where the court is using inherent powers, which are shielded from direct democratic controls, that they must be exercised with restraint and discretion. And we would submit in this instance that the district court abused her discretion in entering these sanctions. And let me address first what I believe is the most serious charge against my client, and that is that he misled Judge Anderson in having an agreed TRO order entered. First of all, in my review of the cases that have dealt with sanctions, this is one of the first cases where I've seen a district court judge sanction a party regarding conduct before another district court judge where the only basis for doing so is a review of the transcript of the record, because how else would either the magistrate judge or that district judge, once removed, have known whether or not that played a significant role. Having reviewed the record, the transcript before Judge Anderson, you will note that when they first appeared on April 7th for the TRO, Judge Anderson met with all the parties privately first and then on the record. On the 8th, he said he had reviewed all of the documents that had been submitted to him to review, and then he said, I am going to tell you what I believe should be the disposition. I'm very troubled by these allegations in the complaint that Chrysler made these racial slurs and was involved in some sort of redlining. And so he said, I am going to issue a TRO. This is my thinking at the moment. I want certain protections in place to protect Chrysler, but I view this as what I am going to do. The parties negotiated a TRO. They came back the next day. They weren't quite ready on the 9th. An affidavit was submitted by my client on the 9th, and on the 11th, the court approved the TRO. Now, I am not suggesting for a moment that if the affidavit was false, somehow that should be discounted. What I am suggesting is, contrary to the district court judge's conclusion, my client's affidavit did not play a significant role at all in him entering that TRO. But first of all, let me emphasize, I do not believe that there was anything false in that affidavit. My client did enter into a transaction with his former attorney, Mr. Vodoliak, that did involve an equity infusion into his dealership. And that was done initially as a loan. Initially, they talked about having papers drawn.
That's a contradiction in terms. If it's a loan, it's not equity.
Well,
that's pretty straightforward.
Yes.
Your Honor, two ways of financing a business, debt and equity. If you finance it with debt and you represent to the court that it's been financed with equity, you're deceiving the court.
Well, Your Honor, I understand the distinction. In the situation here, when my client testified, he said that this was a loan to him, which he then put in.
Well, that turns out not to be true either, does it?
Well, first of all,
why did the dealership pay interest on a loan made to an equity investor?
There were three different payments, and I concede that were done afterwards, and Mr. Vodoliak said I view those as interest payments. Mm-hmm. But the standard here is clear and convincing.
Well, it's no standard is preponderance of the evidence. That's what the Supreme Court says. Rogan against Garner holds that all civil cases are decided by a preponderance of the evidence, no exceptions.
But, Your Honor, when we're dealing, first of all, with this court has held with respect to discovery sanctions on Rule 41.
I know we have one case saying that. We have a lot of cases saying the opposite. And the one case that you rely on that says that did not cite any of the Supreme Court's decisions. So we have an outlier. It's common to have outliers. But one would think we would normally follow recent and unanimous decisions of the Supreme Court.
Let me argue on a preponderance of the evidence, Your Honor, because I do not believe that changes the situation at all. My client said that this was a loan to him by Mr. Vodoliak that then he put into the dealership. And this was a dealership that was owned by my client fault him on his accounting practices. He puts money in, he takes money out, and they may have a beef with respect to whether or not this would violate any of the documents that he signed with Chrysler. But the important fact is it did not have any bearing on the TRO because there were safeguards in the stipulated order that was entered into by the parties.
You know, counsel, I must say I don't understand very much about the structure of this. I don't understand why people are talking about a TRO, which is an ex parte procedure. There was nothing ex parte about this. So what was being entered certainly was not a temporary restraining order. It was probably a preliminary injunction. And I also don't understand why there was all this maneuvering about extra equity. The rule provides a means of securing the adverse party when injunctive relief is ordered, and that means is a bond.
Yes.
Secured, right, by a solvent surety. And the reason why the rule requires a bond secured by a solvent surety is exactly to avoid what happened here. Fast and loose game playing by people who aren't going to have the money in the end. And the games were played. People didn't have the money in the end. Why are the parties not following the rules which call for the security to be in the form of a bond?
I know in the transcript, Your Honor, before Judge Anderson, a bond had been, that issue had been raised, and I think that the district court judge was sympathetic to the plight of the plaintiffs.
Sympathy is not a good reason to take the rules and chuck them out the window.
Your Honor, what Judge Anderson decided was that if there were safeguards in place that would protect...
Well, as we discovered, the safeguards were shams.
Well,
why the rule calls for a bond.
Your Honor, I can't redo what was done, but I do have the record in front of me, and I know that Judge Anderson said that as long as there were safeguards to protect Chrysler, and the safeguards were in that agreed order, and I won't refer to it anymore as a TRO, in that agreed order, that Chrysler would be able to have lender representatives on the premises. They would also have to have a separate proceeds account at a bank that would be agreed to, so that proceeds that were coming in from the sales of these cars would go in the separate proceeds bank. The lender representatives would have access to the books. This was very carefully monitored.
Your Honor. Now tell me, unless I've interrupted you.
No, please.
Would you now, I mean, at this time, after all of this, would you now concede that it was probably a loan rather than an investment?
Yes, I would concede it was a loan to Mr. Gorman.
And what would be the legal effect of the alleged oral modifications to what now looks like we all agree was probably a written loan agreement, regardless of what they thought it was at the time?
Let me address it. There were two principal issues that Chrysler was concerned about and that Judge Anderson recognized, and that was if it was a loan, it'd be unencumbered, and that if it was a loan, that it would be subordinate to any Chrysler debt. That's what happened. Although there may have been some papers that referenced that they were going to be encumbering the current collateral or the cars on the floor, there's no way that those cars could have been subject to a second collateral agreement when Chrysler already had the first position on them anyway. So whether the
in other words, Gorman would be secondarily liable and only by virtue of this oral promise.
He would be essentially responsible. Mr. Vrdoliak said that he would look towards Jerry Gorman, that had done other deals together before, and that that's who he was looking to pay on the loan. Mr. Vrdoliak had received other payments from Midlothian. This related to a prior indebtedness where he had served as a guarantor. Again, Your Honors, there had been a limited financial review, which is by Chrysler, of my client, and that's what triggered this whole situation. It was done in December of 2002. It was done again in September of 2003, just prior to the closing of the dealership. They had access to documents. In fact, their expert wrote a 50-page report. And in their motion for sanctions before the district court and the magistrate judge, they said, with respect to the documents that relate to Midlothian, although they did not have the electronic backup, they had received hard copies of most of the documents and journals up to, I believe they said, September of 2003, with parenthetically a few months missing. So what this whole case is about is a discovery dispute, whether or not the parties properly characterized the transaction with Mr. Vodoliak, and missing notes, which quite frankly would have hurt my client more, even if they were missing. But they're not. They're in the record. We cite in our reply brief where they are. And they were used to support our case. Your Honor, I see my line on. I would like to reserve the balance for my rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Odorizzi.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Michelle Odorizzi for Chrysler Financial.
Ms. Odorizzi, who is your client?
The Daimler Chrysler Financial Services.
That's still an extant entity, even though Chrysler's been spun off?
Chrysler's been spun off, Your Honor, but I believe Chrysler Financial still exists.
Chrysler Financial might exist. Does Daimler Chrysler Financial exist?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Who is paying you?
Well, it's the same people who've been there all along, Your Honor. The same entity.
Make a supplemental filing to tell us who the defendant is at the moment?
Certainly, we will do that, Your Honor. And I apologize, that's something we should have taken care of along the way and it got missed. This isn't just a discovery dispute, as Mr. Eaton said. This isn't just a case of slight inaccuracies. The district court below found that this was a case of lies, evasions, and a pattern of discovery abuse, which the court concluded had seriously harmed Chrysler Financial's ability.
Why didn't Chrysler demand a bond, that is, demand its rights under the law, and then appeal when the district court did not condition the relief on a bond?
Well, Your Honor, they made a choice in the district court. They did ask for a bond. It was clear Judge Anderson wasn't going to do this, wasn't going to impose a bond.
When a district judge says, I'm not going to follow the law, the normal thing that happens is the litigant says, I appeal.
Well, Your Honor, Judge Anderson likes to have the parties agree, and that's what was going on here. It was very clear what he was going to do, and Chrysler Financial did the best they could under the circumstances. And in retrospect, they probably would regret that judgment, but it was a judgment that was made at the time.
Could a lesser sanction have worked just as well here? In other words, the district court could have directed the jury to assume, for instance, that the missing computer contained information that would have supported Chrysler's financial defense?
Well, the district judge thought about that as a sanction and thought about whether or not that would be sufficient.
Now, when you say the district judge, are we talking about Magistrate Judge Keyes, or are we talking about Judge Kendall, who I take it inherited the case from Judge Anderson when she came on the bench.
Right. Well, actually, we're talking about both of them. Both of them reached the same conclusion. But the district judge, Judge Kendall, reached an independent conclusion based on her review of the record. And based on her review of the record, she reached the conclusion that Chrysler's Financial's ability to litigate the charges in the complaint had been seriously damaged and that it could not be cured by having an instruction. She also reached the conclusion that there was serious prejudice to the legal system from the consistent pattern here of lies and evasions during the course of discovery and in the initial hearing on their request for a TRO.
Did the judges take into account these horrendous, inflammatory, racist statements?
Yes, Your Honor. You can't read that complaint without having your flesh crawl. But what the court said is that as to a number of those allegations, you can't even tell because of the saga of the missing notes, of Mr. Gorman's missing notes. We can't even tell whether those were real, if they're fabricated, or what was going on there. And what the court said is that the ability to defend against those very inflammatory, ugly accusations was seriously damaged by the conduct during discovery.
Well, how were they supposed to back up the statements as they're being actually made?
Well, Your Honor, the statements in the complaint, there are a number of them that are quite lengthy, long quotes. And in discovery, we asked initially whether they had tapes, whether they had notes, because who can remember a lengthy quote like that? And they did produce handwritten notes. And those handwritten notes, there are some of the racial slurs that are in the complaint are reflected in those handwritten notes. But when Mr. Gorman was deposed, he was asked, where are the notes that support the initial allegations about Irv Sarovi, who was the zone manager, who basically claimed that he didn't extend credit to African Americans, which Chrysler Financial absolutely denies that that ever occurred. And where are the notes that reflect that? And that's when we start this saga where he says, well, I had notes. I had 8 to 10 pages of additional notes, but I can't find them. I've been looking for them all over, and I can't find them. And as Judge Kendall said, by the end, no one could tell whether or not the notes existed. If they existed, would they support his claim? Would they not support his claim? The whole thing became a complete muddle, and it seriously injures our ability to defend ourselves. Because if he had the notes of those discussions and they didn't have these block quotes in them, then that would certainly support our view that this was not said.
See, we really have two cases going on here.
In what sense, Your Honor?
Well, in the sense that you have these allegations, and it looks as if you have some testimony that these horrible things took place. And then you have that case being totally obliterated by the discovery problems.
Well, the real case here, Your Honor, is a dispute between a dealer and the financing company. And our view has always been that the racial allegations were really a smokescreen for what was going on
yes,
at this dealership.
I understand that is your view.
Right.
That is your view. But there seems to be another. Certainly it's plausible that there was a second case occurring here.
Well, Your Honor,
that will never, ever now, because of the severest sanction, and it doesn't seem to be as if, you know, there was a progression of sanctions. Normally, when you have discovery problems and you have sanctions, there's sanction A, there's sanction B, there's sanction C, and then, and only then, you have three strikes and you're out. You're just out of here.
Well, Your Honor, here there were previous sanctions. a number of previous sanctions, and the district judge, again, took that into account.
Now, what would you say those sanctions were?
There was fees that had to be paid. There was additional deposition time that Mr. Gorman was required to submit to. Their damages expert was stricken because they didn't comply with discovery. There were a number of specific sanctions all along the way as the case went through. Going back to your other point, Your Honor, too, I'd like to point out that there was a class action complaint filed on behalf of consumers, on behalf of customers of these two dealerships on the same day that this complaint was filed. And that went through, and it has been settled and resolved. And that was one of the things that Judge Kendall pointed to and said that was the forum to resolve the issues that were raised about discrimination against the people, alleged discrimination against the people in that lawsuit.
But the two cases, as I understand it, were never consolidated. We're talking about two different judges, are we not?
Two different judges, Your Honor. They were never consolidated. However, the discovery was taken together. The reason Mr. Gorman was deposed so at such length was because he was deposed in both cases at the same time.
So then that wasn't a sanction. In other words, Mr. Gorman's deposition wasn't lengthened as a sanction.
Oh, it was.
It was lengthened because you've got two cases that you're dealing
with. It was lengthened for both reasons, Your Honor. There was also a sanction that was imposed. And he was required to sit for additional days of deposition in this particular case as a sanction. Mr. Eaton said that the affidavit didn't have any impact on Judge Anderson.
So just so I get it straight, having had the class action settled, is it your view that none of the racist component to this case would have been part of this case?
Well, Your Honor, it certainly the plaintiffs, their position was that there was race discrimination and that they were economically hurt because their customers were being denied credit by Chrysler Financial. That was their position. So, yes, they certainly would have brought it into the case. Our view was that there was no discrimination in lending and that they were not hurt economically at all, and that the reason they went out of business is because of mismanagement and looting of the dealership.
But the same parties that are the defendants in this case were the defendants in the class action, I take it.
Yes. Yes. That's true.
It's a conundrum, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, no matter how serious the allegations are here, and certainly, those allegations, as I said, they're reprehensible slurs in it. Those are very serious. But you have to play by the rules, no matter how serious your allegations are. And that means you have to tell the truth, particularly when you're under oath, and that you have to be forthcoming and act in good faith in discovery. And I don't think you can look at the saga of the computer here and what we went through trying to get their computer and say that these people were acting in good faith. You know, in the beginning of this lawsuit, it started out with a lengthy letter from plaintiff's counsel to Chrysler lecturing us on our responsibilities to preserve information, and particularly information that was kept on computer. Well, here they are. They not only don't preserve what's on their computer, but they lie to us about where their computer is. We spend months trying to get our hands on that computer, and all the while you have evasions, and you have Mr. Gorman saying the computer's not there, he doesn't know where it is, he's looked at every inch of the store, and it's undisputed that it was sitting there in his office. And that's the kind of conduct that Judge Keyes looked at and that Judge Kendall looked at and said the system just can't tolerate that kind of conduct. In fact, in some ways, because of the inflammatory nature of the accusations, it was very important that we be allowed to fight on a level playing field. And that's what they denied us here. Mr. Eaton says, well, there really wasn't anything important that was missing from the discovery. But we had an affidavit on the sanctions from our expert who says there was a lot missing from their discovery production. The general ledger wasn't there. You can't track transactions as well as you might otherwise. There are other things missing. There are reports missing. So that, yes, while we can see that there was looting of the dealership, there were bad things going on here, you cannot prove it to the extent that you could otherwise. And the same thing with the missing notes. If the notes were something we could have used to impeach him, they're gone forever. They're gone forever. And what the court said is that this prejudices not only Chrysler Financial in this case, but the legal system.
Now tell me this. Was the same evidence that would have been used in this case used in the class action case?
Yes, Your Honor.
So were the notes there?
No, Your Honor, no. In fact, there's a summary judgment ruling by Judge Phillip on the class action case where he goes through the evidence that there was, and he did deny summary judgment to Chrysler, although it's quite clear that each of the individual plaintiffs could not show, and he found that they couldn't show that any of them had been damaged. And the evidence of discrimination just really isn't there.
And yet the case was settled.
And then the case was settled. It was settled. There was no payment of damages to any individual. It was settled for fees, a charitable contribution, and a redoubling of Chrysler's efforts to make sure that there is no racial discrimination in their system. So we would ask the court to please affirm the judgment below.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Eaton?
Yes.
Judge Rovner, let me address several of your questions. First of all, you had asked, did the district judges take into account the racial slurs? And I can assure you, based on the transcript before Judge Anderson, that he did. He said several times these are very serious charges. And he asked on three different occasions, Mr. Bay, Chrysler's attorney, do you deny those allegations? And he said, I'm not in a position to be able to do that because that employee is now gone. He thought those were so serious that for Chrysler, which was our complaint, to be running this dealer out of business, that he was going to allow, I won't use the word tarot, he was going to allow an order be entered that would require financing to continue. The charges that we made in our complaint against Chrysler Financial are exactly the charges the consumer class action were making based upon the same notes and the same allegations. And in our reply brief, we attach a table where we refer to deposition testimony of people who heard those comments being made. This isn't just based on the notes. And first of all, the notes are not missing. The public interest that is involved here is that if the dealers who have the firsthand information about what's being said by Chrysler Financial in those meetings aren't able to come forward and say, this is what Chrysler is doing, that consumer class action never would have occurred because they're based upon a dealer's notes. And Judge Kendall respectfully seems to think that she has a pass in dismissing our case because the consumer class action settled. That consumer class action was based upon notes that my client took. This is an extremely important issue. If a dealer comes forward and says, I see issues here of redlining, I see serious racial slurs being made, and Chrysler has this aggressive defense and basically pulls our financing, goes in and does a complete audit and says, I'm not sure you're good here, not good here, and runs us out of business. That's what's at stake here, and we would respectfully submit that just because the consumers were taken care of, that my client's rights cannot be protected. And in every instance, in fact, I was quoting when I quoted earlier from their expert reports that he had received most of the accounting journals. We have two limited financial reviews that were done of my client where they had boxes of documents. He has a 50-page report. He also said most of the information is there in paper form. So what we're talking about is a situation where, and we tried to help him find the electronic data. There were efforts made by our counsel. So bottom line is, if there are credibility issues, let a jury decide that, not have a judge give what is ultimately the death penalty and dismiss this case with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.